Welcome to the Zur Institute's LLC audio recording on subsequent therapist syndrome. I'm your host, Nola Nordmarken, MFT. I have private practices in both Santa Monica, California and South Pasadena, and as well, I have co-authored several CE courses and articles with Dr. Zur. Those include touch and psychotherapy, home office practice, the professional will, articles critiquing the DSM. It's my pleasure today for this program to interview Dr. Ofer Zur about his views and concerns regarding how subsequent therapists respond to their clients when they report what might be somewhat questionable information about a former therapist. This recording is part of an online course on subsequent therapist syndrome by the Zur Institute at www.zurinstitute.com. Dr. Zur, are you with us?
I'm with you. I'm very excited to talk about this new and kind of interesting topic. So thank you for the interview.
Thank you so much for joining us. Ofer Zur is a licensed psychologist, fellow of American Psychological Association. He's an instructor, a lecturer, an ethics consultant. He's an expert witness in private psychotherapy practice. His office is in Sonoma, California. He's been practicing for over 20 years and is also director of the Zur Institute, LLC, at, again, www.zurinstitute.com. Zur Institute offers over 150 innovative and challenging online continuing education courses for psychologists, counselors, social workers, nurses, and other mental health professionals. He's most known for his effort to humanize the field of psychotherapy and counseling, and he is a fierce advocate for the use of appropriate and flexible application of therapeutic boundaries. He's been a visionary in the field for a long time, going way back to the 1980s. He warned us about the potential problems with managed care, and he's taught many of us how to practice outside managed care on a fee-for-service basis. I happen to be one of those who benefited greatly in many ways by making that change. In the 90s, he advocated strongly to humanize the field of psychotherapy and counseling by teaching us how to apply therapeutic boundaries, flexibility and care, rather than rigidity and fear. Then in 2002, he saw HIPAA coming our way, and he wrote the HIPAA compliance kit. These days, he's shifted his attention to telehealth or telemental health, which he views as one of the most important developments in our field of psychotherapy and counseling. In today's unique audio, or may I say pioneer recording, Dr. Zur will explore the complexities that are facing us as therapists when we have a client who reports the conduct of a former therapist. This might include behavior that we think is ethically or legally out of bounds or simply below what we believe should be the adequate standard of care. So let's start. Dr. Zur, Dr. Zur?
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure we got cut off for a second, but go ahead.
Okay.
I can hear you right now.
I was just asking if I could call you Ofer.
Of course, yeah.
And you can call me Nola.
Okay.
Would you just start with a definition of the term subsequent therapist syndrome?
Yeah, the definition of the subsequent therapist syndrome, it's a term that refers to those circumstances where the subsequent therapist, current, it can be next or new therapist, may act unethically or even illegally when providing an, quote, expert opinion or, quote, formal assessment regarding a former therapist's supposedly or reportedly unethical or legal conduct. So these are the cases where subsequent therapist evaluation and judgment are solely based on the theoretical bias, the rigid view of therapeutic boundaries, and also only based on client self-report without any review of psychotherapy records of the former or the other therapist, without consulting with the former therapist or reviewing any other collateral evidence.
I don't believe I ever heard this term before. Did you coin it yourself?
I did coin this term, subsequent therapy syndrome, to identify again this situation where regretfully ill-informed or at times self-righteous mental health practitioners are eager to tell the current client that the former therapists are acted unethically or illegally just because the former therapists use different approaches, different methodologies or intervention that one subsequent therapist, that the subsequent therapist subscribe or doesn't subscribe to. So kind of it's a subjective opinion. While some subsequent therapists respond to clients' complaints without their former therapist knowledge or interviewing them, many of them put fire under the client who doesn't even have a negative evaluation of their past therapies by telling them about the wrong that the former therapist did, or urge them to file a lawsuit or to file a board complaint, etc. But in short, the answer is, I did coin the term. When you go to Google and you Google subsequent therapy syndrome, only my two or three articles will come up, and now this course too.
So when you use the term syndrome, do you mean it literally or?
You know, not really. While we are dealing with a serious and destructive professional phenomenon among therapists, counselors, social worker, the term itself, subsequent therapy syndrome, is somewhat tongue-in-cheek. It's not a real syndrome as we know it in psychotherapy or a DSM kind of syndrome.
I know you've been pretty critical of psychotherapists in the past for not being very flexible in regard to boundaries, or also not being tolerant with regard to other theoretical interventions. And there's some strong relevancy to those issues in this discussion, I'm sure.
You're absolutely right. Psychotherapists, in my view, have not been known to be highly tolerant or flexible. In spite of our token commitment to individual differences or cultural diversity, the therapists often fail to acknowledge or to say, I would have approached the situation differently. They don't say the theoretical orientation to which I subscribe would not endorse such an intervention. Or simply, therapists don't know how to say, I disagree. Instead, what they often say, it is inappropriate, and even more common for them to say, it's unethical. So instead of saying, I really don't have a basis to which form an opinion on a matter of how you other therapists perform, they'll say it's illegal or it's substandard care. So we don't know how to say, I disagree, or even I don't know, or I don't have enough information.
You seem to hold the view that subsequent therapists are often the initiators of board complaints or civil lawsuits against their clients' former therapists. Is that the case?
I have talked to fellow experts and attorneys, and it seems like that every one of them that I ask a question have encountered subsequent therapy syndrome, who started the whole idea of board complaint or civil lawsuits. In my own forensic and expert witness work, as well as consultants with therapists over many, many years, I've come across numerous times when the subsequent therapists condemn a legitimate, effective, and ethical intervention by the former therapist just because they don't endorse such interventions, and indeed puts a fire underneath the client who didn't even know in the first place that anything was not okay or not right.
Could you share some examples with us?
Yes. For example, examples that comes to mind that I have encountered in my consulting or forensic work is like when the former therapist, for example, use ethical and clinically effective physical touch, something you and I wrote about, to soothe or distress clients. And they'll say, no, touch is not part of psychotherapy, not part of social work, and it's substandard care. Or as a critique when a former therapist will make a clinically appropriate home visit, even when the client is agoraphobic. I consulted one time on a case like that. or when the former therapist used clinically beneficial extensive self-disclosures, and the subsequent therapist will be critical of that. They'll be critical on texting done by former therapist, even when it was done with a young suicidal client late into the night, and they sexualize it, where they sexualize touch or sexualize everything that doesn't fall within their limited scope of what is supposed to be in therapy. So I have tons of examples. One example I heard a subsequent therapist criticize a former therapist for signing an email with a long-term, intermittent, high-functioning client of 20 years with love, so-so, kind of just signing the email with a generic love and his name. And I have tons of... I can spend an hour just on examples.
So these therapists actually go ahead and initiate board complaints or civil lawsuits against the therapists. That's concerning.
Not really. The therapists usually do not. Sometimes the therapists write a letter to the board, complaint boards, or to support the clients, and they don't even say that they don't have any objective information. They just take it as if it's true. Most of the time, they put the fire underneath the clients to file a complaint.
So when you say initiators of board complaints, they do it through the client.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry. Yeah, this is a good... Most of the time, sometimes they initiate themselves. I have definitely seen enough... subsequent therapist who wrote directly to the board it's not so much as they wrote it to the board, the way they wrote it to the board, as if these are facts and if these are verified, proven fact, rather than is a hearsay from the client.
So I'm looking at the humor in your tongue-in-cheek presentation of STS, as you call it, where you seem to imitate the DSM and provide certain criteria or qualifications for the syndrome. Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Yeah, you're right. It is a little bit some tongue-in-cheek in my presentation, even though, again, it's a very serious problem.
I like the way it starts out. To qualify for the subsequent therapist syndrome, STS, at least 5 of the following 10 symptoms must be present in order to make assessment of STS. That sounds very DSM-ish.
Yeah, it is DSM-ish, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but the content is very serious. And I'm ready to give quickly the list of these 10 qualifications. One, the subsequent therapist arrive at negative assessment of former therapy based solely on the client self-report without having any data to support it. 2, subsequent therapists unquestionably accept client self-reporting regarding the former therapist at face value, believing it's true, complete, accurate, and valid. 3, subsequent therapist disapproval of former therapist is based on their own subsequent therapy theoretical or other biases. 4, subsequent therapist disapproval of the former therapist conduct is based on the subsequent therapist or subsequent therapist's inflexible, narrow, or misinformed view of therapeutic boundaries, such as touch, leaving the office, bartering, home visit. 5, subsequent therapist self to be self-righteous. 6, subsequent therapists tend to ignore the fact that false accusations by clients are not uncommon. Sometimes clients do not perceive reality correctly, and this is part of why they're coming to see us in therapy. 7, subsequent therapists do not seem to be aware that they have strong theoretical orientation bias. This is so common in our field. Subsequent therapists fail to say, I respectfully disagree, and instead claim this is unethical. 9, subsequent therapy strongly encourages and often insists the client file licensing board complaint or malpractice suit against a former therapist. 10, subsequent therapist goes beyond the role of therapist or clinician and enter into ill-advised and a potential unethical forensic dual relationship when serving as a therapist as well as forensic expert. This is a very important one. They often write letters, reports to the client's attorney or to the board as if they are experts who did investigations, while they are really just heard the client's version and the client's complaint.
I could see where a therapist doing that might actually put themselves at risk of malpractice. Is that true?
You know, I don't think the subsequent therapists have really encountered that problem yet. My hope is that it will bring enough awareness that people will be more cautious. And because usually the boards kind of use their testimonies, whether they are ethical or not. So I think it should result in some risk. It hasn't yet. Hopefully, this is a new way of presenting a problem, making therapists cautious before they step into expert while being just a subsequent therapist or start writing long letters to boards or to the courts.
Did I give you a chance to finish? You were 10?
Yeah, this was a 10, and again, a little bit tongue-in-cheek. If they fulfill five of them, they will qualify.
But a lot of seriousness as a basis. Over, some would say that therapists have a moral, clinical, ethical, and maybe even legal obligation to protect the public from incompetent or predatory therapists. What are your thoughts on that?
It's so true. I'm so pleased you brought it up. We do have an obligation to protect our clients. So there are situations where indeed we hear outrageous behavior by former therapists, and there are ways to express it. For example, rather than giving a conclusive expert opinion about the former therapist's conduct, a subsequent therapist can say something like, "If what you told me is correct, I'm very concerned about the conduct of your former therapist. However, I'm aware that I only have one side, your side of the story, and I really don't have a basis on which to form a conclusive opinion on the matter. Nevertheless, if it is true that what you said, I'm ready and open to explore some options with you." And I know therapists don't use these things. They're afraid the clients will be insulted. "Oh, you don't believe me," or whatever it is. But the fact is that we don't know, and we need to tell the client. And it's so true what you said, that there are situations, for example, in California, if you hear that the client told you that his sexual relationship with a former therapist, within 2 years after therapy or during therapy in the state of California, you must provide a client a pamphlet of professional therapy never involve sex, which inform clients about the rights and the therapist's responsibility. So there are sometimes a situation where we need to respond. For example, if a subsequent therapist hear about sexual relationship of former therapist with a minor client, that's, of course, involve a mandated reporting. So you're right. We do have an obligation to hold the standard of our profession. And there are some therapists who are crossing the line and providing substandard care. And we need to protect the public. But we need to protect it in an ethical and legal and appropriate way, not just running the information that the clients give us and draw conclusions.
So, basically, we're saying we're not the judge and jury.
We are not, and we are not experts. We are not expert forensic experts either.
You've advocated embracing appropriate or helpful dual relationships. You seem to view forensic dual relationships in a much more cautious and way, and in more negative terms.
You're so right. It's kind of, people ask me this question and they say, you know, you from all people who kind of with Lazarus. We wrote a book about a dual relationship back in 2002, sorry, and that some dual relationships are mandated, others are normal, and some others are even helpful. But we see that forensic dual relationship are not compatible with the therapist, because as a forensic expert, you need to be objective and to give the judge or the jury or the board expert opinion. But as a therapist, you have an obligation to preserve the wellness, the welfare. You have an obligation for the welfare of the clients. And these two things are not really compatible. Sometimes expert report in forensic situation can end up in client being sentenced for life, whatever, if they find them fitness to stand trial or whatever it is. So these two roles are incompatible, and most association really agree with that. The forensic expert role and therapeutic role are not compatible, and I agree with that. Now, in some situation, you don't have a choice, and it's a mandated dual relationship, sometimes it can happen in prison, but this is besides the point.
Over in the span of your long career, have you witnessed subsequent therapists taking inappropriate action?
Tons of them, as I mentioned, not only me, many others. Marty William wrote about this issue many years ago, Dr. Williams from California, and I have seen it many times. I would say that more than half of the forensic cases that I've reviewed, it's a subsequent therapist that came up with not only with a wonder or questioning the conduct of the former therapist, but actually with an assessment of that it was substandard care and inappropriate, etc. So yes, I've seen a lot of it. This is why I came up with term. This is why I wrote the articles about it, available on the website for free, and also part of this course. So yes, I've seen a lot, and my colleagues have seen quite a bit, and so were the attorneys that I've worked with.
So subsequent therapists may be acting out of scope of their own expertise, which may in itself constitute an ethical violation.
It's so true. Another potential of area of unethical conduct by the subsequent therapist in when they testify as experts and they don't have the expertise of being an investigator. They are not an investigator. They do not have the expertise to make a harm assessment, because how they can say somebody was harmed without getting the data of what was the level of functioning or what was happening in the person's life prior to the so-called violation. So they are acting out of scope when they make harm assessment, and they are acting out of scope sometimes when they testify that the other therapist had a substandard care because they're not expert of the substandard care. Now, acting out of scope is a potential unethical or illegal action on the therapist. So you're absolutely right. Acting out of scope is a major concern here.
Ofer, we're coming to the end of the interview, and I wonder if you could just summarize for us, what is it that you're hoping to accomplish by raising these issues and coining this term, STS?
My hope is that this interview, the article, or the online course will help psychotherapists, counselors, social workers, psychiatrists become more reflective and more thoughtful about the concerns when they hear certain information from clients regarding the former therapist's conduct. The intention of all of this work, my work in this area, is to help therapists to be more aware of their own biases, not much different what I've done around issues of boundaries, and to use better judgment and much better wording when they help clients sort out the evaluation of the former therapist. It is important, as you brought up, that therapists protect the public from incompetent or predatory professionals, but it must be done in an ethical, rational, and conscientious way, that when therapists, we do not become, continue to be our own enemies and turning each other in, and sometimes inappropriately unethical.
Thanks, Sofer, for once again bringing us another intriguing idea, for challenging the field to think critically, to fight dogma, and so much more. I'm looking forward to seeing what develops next. Again, thank you, Ofer.
Thank you so much, you really, for a fantastic interview and bringing the main issues so clearly to the front. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.